Hello, and welcome to the internet, and welcome to Let's Just Chat. My name is Matt Feuerstein, and I will be the host of this thing that you're listening to. And joining me this week to discuss the fourth season of Arrested Development are Newsarama.com staff writer Albert Ching and beloved podcast guest Justin Shapiro. And we're recording this approximately 1 week, actually exactly 1 week after the release of these episodes, so we've had a good amount of time to get perspective. And Albert, your article was the inspiration for this podcast. How are you today?
I'm feeling very good that I inspired you. And, you know, 25 years from now, when Let's Just Chat is inducted into the Podcast Hall of Fame, I think we're all going to look back at this episode as a historic moment and kind of a game changer for the medium. And to be any part of that feels tremendous.
Well, I am very much looking forward to changing some games around. I'm really not crazy about the rules of football, so I'm going to try and start with that. Justin Shapiro.
Hey.
You're a small man. How are you today?
Well, you know, still the same.
As?
Albert.
Okay, well, I mean, Albert is significantly taller than you.
Not gonna let you forget
your lack of height.
I think it's subjective, so. But okay.
Yeah, small man also sounds like you could be talking about his character. And I think we should make it clear that you're not, I hope.
Just leave that up to you to interpret.
This is the kind of banner that's getting us nominated for a potty.
Yes, that. And
which isn't a word they give to toilets.
Also, just an actual toilet. Yep. Get us nominated to win a free baby toilet.
I need that toilet.
A baby toilet, that sounds adorable. Most babies, I don't know if you guys know this, don't use toilets.
So just a diaper, really.
Yeah. We're going to win a free diaper.
Fingers crossed. For
size for infants. But before that, we got to talk about Arrested Development. And Albert, your article, which was on theatlantic.com, and if you listeners want to find the article, and you should Google Arrested Development, Albert Ching. And the article is entitled, Who Cares What Happens in the New Arrested Development Episodes?
What a provocative headline.
You took some editorial influence with your inflection on that.
Who gives a flying crap what happens in these episodes? And the kind of the subtitle is, All That Matters Is That They're Funny. And for a 2013 sitcom, that's surprisingly unusual. So let's just dive right in, Albert. Do you still agree that what happens in the episodes is really not that important after seeing them and seeing how densely plotted and layered the whole thing was?
Well, I don't think I ever was making the argument that it wasn't important. What I was trying to say, and I very well could have failed, is that the purpose of, you know, the dense plots and various layers and complexities are to pay off jokes primarily. And I think that's still true, although, I mean, but certainly, you know, I think it's compelling as well. I just think, you know, the ends is always, you know, comedy first.
And Justin, do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think it's a big show on structure, but all that structure, especially in the new experimental crazy season from the future, is designed for comedy.
Do you think that Arrested Development's emphasis on structure and the way the jokes were structured, do you think that they had a profound lasting influence on television comedy in general as seen now about 10 years after its original premiere, or do you think that its influence is sort of still to be determined?
You want to go in alphabetical
order? Let's start with Justin.
Whoa. Reversal of fortune. Yeah, I haven't given too much thought to drawing a through line on, like, the evolution of comedies people like that are lowly rated over the last 10 years. Single camera, I don't think you can necessarily lay at the feet of Arrested Development, since The Office and, of course, Malcolm in the Middle, and I guess Scrubs came slightly before it. I think 30 Rock, for sure, is kind of a natural successor to that. And then The Offices sort of sprung off their own little family between extras and Parks and Recreation and more offices across this great earth. But I do think it's been a fun week or month for their legacy of the show, where people sort of come back to where it all started and say, hey, remember this? They really did it right.
Albert, there's a whole subset of sitcoms that maybe have something of a cult following, but sort of have this kind of madcap, fast-paced banter aspect to them, like such as A Happy Endings, Community in some respects. Do you think those can all be tied directly to Arrested Development, or do you think those would have come about organically without Arrested Development?
Yeah, I mean, I think Arrested Development probably made it a little easier and helped it along, and certainly I would imagine that the people behind those shows are probably all Arrested Development fans. And I think, you know, you can see it a lot, you know, sort of in what Justin was saying, in maybe the pacing of the shows and kind of the way, you know, some things like cutaways and various jokes are laid out. I think there's definitely some influence there, even if the shows themselves are structured differently.
I would for sure, if I may interject, and I will, you would think there would be more influence to Community, but whenever, I mean, Dan Harmon, who, congratulations, big weekend for that guy, kind of runs away from that, and it's maybe you don't need to take all of his literal explanations of the show, but he'll always say, no, we're Cheers, for sure. None of that. He claims he had to deliberately seek out the new single-camera comedy so he could figure out how to do that kind of show. Although, in that sense, I guess it is directly influenced. It just wasn't, like, from a fan perspective.
Does that ring true to you, Justin?
I never know what's going on with that guy, so I'd hate to speculate.
I definitely thought when I first saw Community in its first few episodes that there was a strong Arrested Development influence. And obviously the fact that Dan Harmon is such a visionary, he very quickly made it his own and kind of made it its own thing to the point where I almost think in some ways it's more groundbreaking than Arrested Development, and to the degree that I think it might actually – people might actually have a harder time replicating some of its strengths than they would with Arrested Development. But before we get into Community, because I think that is something we can talk about later on, let's kind of go back to the beginning. I know for me, as far as TV shows goes, and I think the same will probably be true for almost anyone around my age, my socioeconomic background, so to speak, The Simpsons was a very important formative experience for me, kind of not only helped define my sense of humor from an early age, but, you know, melodramatically as it sounds, kind of helped define me as a person, just in terms of my sensibilities toward the world, my, you know, the cynicism of kind of our generation, the amount of sarcasm and skepticism we bring to different situations. And I think that Arrested Development sort of did the same thing for me in my college years. All three of us were in college when the show premiered. Actually, the two of you are among the only people I know that were actually watching from the very, very beginning, and were the ones who kind of got me watching. I think I started about halfway through the first season by watching a mini marathon on FX and kind of got me up to speed. What is it that led you to watch the first episode when it aired before you really knew anything about it? And what is it about the show that really made it catch your attention and made it one of your favorites? I'll start with Albert.
I first started watching it because of David Cross's involvement, I think, because I was such a big fan of Mr. Show, and I knew he was in a new show, and, you know, it had good buzz around it, and I think that's really what got me hooked. And, you know, the first episode, I think, still is really good for a comedy pilot, which can be rough, as we all know, sometimes, because it's kind of hard to establish what's funny about a show from the first episode when you're introducing a lot of characters and elements. And so I really think that was it. I think it was the fact that David Cross was in it and then just it being good.
And Justin, how about you? That same question.
Yeah, it seems funny in retrospect, but if I remember right, a strange number of ads on Fox during the Major League Baseball playoffs advertising that show. And I mean, I don't remember exactly how the context of those commercials, but I assume they didn't really sell it as what it was, but more of a zany madcap family thing. potentially the next Skins, or maybe Skins came the next year. But then, so I think I just watched it because it was on, and then from that first pilot and just the stylistic choices they made, the fact that everyone played it very straight, like this was serious business for everyone on the show, they were going through a serious situation, and the jokes just happened to come naturally out of the show. There's a joke in the pilot, which I agree, I think it's like the best pilot. It's I wouldn't say fully formed, just because the show took so many steps from that point, but the joke about the blue part must be the land, and then it's not like people stare and like arch their eyebrows at him. He says it, and if you catch it, then congratulations, a wonderful joke for you. And things they were doing with the direction that I don't know if it's the second or third episode with Bring Up Buster, where they have these shots of people having conversations about him, and then they cut back and show him that he'd actually been sitting there the whole time. It was just kind of, I mean, I don't want to default to the word mind-blowing too much, but for me at that point, I couldn't believe this was happening in a TV show, and it was possible to contain this in a TV show. So I think 4 or 5 episodes in, I was close to deciding that this was my favorite show ever.
Yeah, it's interesting. In the case of Arrested Development, now it's so known for how densely plotted it is and all the callbacks to the jokes and the hidden jokes. And in the very early going, just based on the fact that it would have been impossible for that to exist with only a couple episodes, it didn't exist at that point. So it was pretty much running on the fact that its jokes were funny in the moment. And like you said, there was a speed to which the jokes were delivered. And I think the acting style was pretty unique for television at the time. Jason Bateman's sarcastic character obviously was certainly not the first sarcastic straight man on TV, but it does seem to me that there are a lot more characters that kind of take his tone now than there used to be. What's
and
interesting...
He, oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, he credits that whole thing to Jeffrey Tambor. He says, like, when they sat down to shoot one of the first scenes, and then he just followed Tambor's lead, who played things really straight. He's a man who's been arrested and incarcerated, and the whole family business is in trouble, and he acted the way someone in that situation largely would, as in, this is bad, and no winking, I think, is the term they always come back to.
And absolutely, and one of the interesting things about Arrested Development, well, for one thing, it was on Fox, and Fox in 2003 was still not very far removed from kind of its era of ridicule, where a large percentage of its programming was when animals attack and, you know, the worst car crashes or
Temptation
things like
Island.
That.
Ooh.
Temptation
Joe
Island.
Millionaire.
I think it was the same year that the Littlest Groom aired, all that stuff. So, but at the same time, Fox had cultivated this legacy of putting on some pretty daring and groundbreaking television shows. Well, The Simpsons is an obvious one. Married with Children, obviously, another one. It had The Critic for a little while, Futurama, even Family Guy at that point. But there, you know, in the midst of its daring, there were a decent amount of failures, and some of them were better than others. And about a year before Arrested Development came out, the show that was kind of getting a lot of the buzz for Fox, as far as the kind of the cult comedy hit, was Andy Richter Controls the Universe. Mm. And in some ways, its early buzz was very similar to Arrested Development, and it suffered a similar fate in that it was canceled very early. But the passion inspired by both shows can't be compared. Arrested Development inspired a different plane of passion and excitement and enthusiasm from its fans. What was it? I mean, Justin sort of got to it, but Albert, what do you think it was about Arrested Development that separated it from previous and future cult shows, cult comedy shows in particular?
Well, I think just by the nature of it, rewarding audience, paying a lot of attention and patience, and it's the kind of show that, you know, you really can't like a little, or else I don't think you would appreciate a lot of what makes it so great. It's a show that you really have to kind of devote yourself to and really watch closely. It's not something you can just have on in the background, you know, while you're like, you know, futzing around the living room. It's something that you really have to, you know, engage with. And I think that attracts people who are going to be more passionate anyway.
And I think you could see from the pilot and the first handful of episodes, so much thought had already gone into envisioning this whole world in Balboa County and beyond. You have the father and son who literally live in the model home, and then just so many different locations that would become iconic over the show, between the prison and the banana stand, etc. And then the detail that went into characters' names, between everybody named George and then George Michael and two Lucilles. It was just, I mean, all of this stuff is antithetical to becoming a hit show right off the bat. But if you were paying attention, you start to say, man, what is going on here?
Yeah, and the brains behind all that was Mitchell Hurwitz. And as far as creative geniuses go, he's one of the more mild-mannered ones that I can think of. Dan Harmon kind of has this this kind of confrontational aspect to him. Certainly, if you think about other shows, Larry David, talk about dramas, someone like David Simon, David Chase, there are eccentricities to these people, even Louis C.K. Whereas you listen to a Mitchell Hurwitz, and he just sounds like a nice, funny Jewish guy.
Yeah, fun. And, huh? It's basically the gist I get from him.
Yes, and given his background, which I think dates back to the Golden Girls, and I believe he was the showrunner for Golden Palace, the famed Golden Girls spinoff, and I say famed in some semblance of an ironic sense.
An early Don Cheadle project.
Absolutely. And a
John Larroquette show.
And a late Rue McClanahan project.
The late Rue McClanahan.
And it's interesting to realize that all of this insanity came from that mind. How much do you think that the layers of Arrested Development seasons 1, 2, and 3 were already in the works starting at the beginning? Do you think there are a lot of clues that show that maybe Buster losing his hand was known very early on, or do you think that kind of these things were epiphanies as the show was being written, Justin?
Maybe a little bit of each. I think probably at the beginning of each season they had long-term plans. I mean, I know the whole family as he envisioned it, I'm sure, was fully formed, and some of the supporting people. And then they didn't even know, you know, they were going to have 22 episodes. So probably 1 through 13 and all of the sort of core aspects of the show, the cousin relationship and things like that. Marta, I would think, was sketched out for a while. So all of that comes to a head, and then they kind of pick up from there with the Saddam Hussein thing, which I believe I remember hearing was something they conceived of like partway through the year, just picking up on jokes they'd peppered in about light treason, and then the design of the house looking like Saddam's palace. And then at the end, you had this big reveal, and some people who saw H. Mattis coolers were very happy to be rewarded like that. And then with the second season, I think they tried to set out a similar path with all the hints about the Lucille and the hand coming off. And then season 3 was so chaotic from the scheduling that I'm not sure what got compressed, what got left out, what got picked up again in the resurrected season, but for sure a lot of forethought went into the Rita run of episodes. And then you also hear just Arcania about storylines they had planned that got dropped. I think Anyang as the mastermind of their downfall was something that was supposed to happen in season 2, but it was cut out when they were reduced from 22 episodes to 18. So I think clearly they like organization, as you can tell by the amount of stuff they embed and call forward to. But I also think up until this season, and even this season was, I'm sure, a product of people's schedules and what they could do, it's forethought, but it's also forethought you have to plan on the fly and deal with the realities of being a network TV show.
Now, let's let's kind of go back to the beginning and go season by season. I recently was watching some of the first season, and I know you guys have also recently watched some of the first season, or in Justin's case, all of it. And a lot of people probably did the same thing in preparation for these new episodes. What I noticed about the first season that really struck me, and I've always loved the first season, it's probably still my favorite. It's at least in the first half of the first season, there was a much quieter pace to the show. And slower pace and kind of a quieter tone, I should say. There was less background music. There were more sentimental moments. The narration was literally spoken more quietly. The characters were more realistic. Lindsay especially has changed a lot since those very early episodes. Do you think that tonally, if the show had stuck to its first season kind of tone, do you think it would have worked as well, or do you think it was a necessity for the show to get more and more and more insane as it went? Albert.
I mean, I don't know about necessity. It's hard to say, because I agree that the first season is great, and the first season, you know, I haven't specifically noticed the difference between the first half of the season, but I'm sure if I went back and watched more, I would pick up on what you're laying out there. But I think it evolved well. I think it was the shape it took made sense, and, you know, there was, you know, throughout the run of the show, and including season four, I feel like there wasn't stuff that no matter how, you know, at face insane or crazy it got, felt like it really betrayed the show's premise or the show's character. So they were always very skillful at doing things that, you know, still are consistent with the show's tone and the show's world.
Justin, do you feel like season one had any particular strengths that were maybe missing from later seasons?
Well, I actually read, I hate this sentence, but there's no other way, read a great Tumblr article. It's funny, in the early days, I would always read the episode threads on the website Television Without Pity, for it was just a good place to compile jokes, and this was at a time when you couldn't just have anything you wanted on the internet, and you had to seek a specific source for it. And I think, I don't remember when that the OP website that cataloged all the references on the show, I think it came during the first season. But anyway, so those were the two go-to places. And now you can just go to Reddit or whatever, and I'm sure people are going nuts about pointing everything out about this. But there was a guy I remembered really liking his posts. I have no idea who he is. And then he was back. He was back in 2013 talking about Arrested Development. Wrote a very nice piece about it. He pointed out something that I remember was part of the tone of the conversation that the fan base had, where some people got annoyed that the back half of season one wasn't as dry and serious and realistic in quotation marks as the first half. And then in season two, things start to look, you know, more outward about the world as opposed to just inward about the world of the Bluths, and you have things like the Iraq War incorporated, and people were sort of pushed back against that broadening. And then if they were going to do that for two, they certainly did it with season three, when there was a love arc with a secretly retarded woman and all kinds of madcap frantic stuff going on. Which then came to this season when people just wanted season three back because this was all wrong and this is not the Arrested Development they wanted. As I damn everyone with faint paraphrase and do all their arguments no justice. But yeah, I think I would say season one sort of built the sandbox and then season two got to play around in it. And I think there's a, I'm sure it's a trend for most shows that characters sort of regress to some defining characteristics and the tone gets a little more broad. And I would say they managed it better than some other office-based sitcoms who weren't really able to hold it together as they had to continue to produce more and more episodes. So, I would agree with Albert. There was nothing – things changed and maybe softened or broadened, but it was all within the spirit and inventiveness of the show.
Do you think that the and I'll address this to you again, Justin. Do you think that the sentimentality, and maybe that's just too strong of a word, but the emotional aspects of the early episodes, and a lot of the early episodes ended with kind of kind of a tender scene, some tender music between George Michael and Michael, or Michael and Lindsay. Do you think that they could have or should have done more with that as the series progressed, or do you think that that was sort of a, sort of a television trope that was kind of gone to in the early years that they later realized maybe wasn't so necessary after all?
Well, I think there were some genuinely touching moments between the family relationships in the early episodes, and I would even say some as it goes on. Characters like Lindsay and Tobias, or more so Lindsay, who, like you said, was sort of not quite Michael's equal, but also maybe the normalest of the Blues. I think there's some dialogue early on where he says she's the closest person to him, and once you get into their open marriage, she sort of becomes much more of a funny caricature. But a lot of those early moments, they always undercut it with jokes, too. There's the, like, Michael and George and Michael have these father-son talks where, but it ends with a line like, they're having a talk as they're both being sent to prison, or he comforts George Michael by telling him that his grandfather is guilty. So there was always that joke element there, which I think goes back to the whole model home thing, and that this is parodying the family relationships of, like, their TV forebears.
And if
Albert,
I can interject, sorry.
Sure.
But structurally, I think that's important to establish that these characters care about each other to whatever extent that they do early on. So, you know, what comes later still kind of makes sense. You know, it's not just that this is all funny, wacky, that there is a heart to it, no matter how bizarre it can be displayed. I think that's important early on, that they had some of the more tender moments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there are, like, relationship beats between Buster and Lucille, Job and Michael, even later on as the show gets into Crazy Town, that even though they're embedded in, like, the weirdest situations, are pretty touching.
That's interesting. And Albert, one of your points in your article was that Arrested Development was pretty much exclusively concerned with being funny, as opposed to The Office, which, at least in later years, kind of wanted to make you feel for these characters almost as much as they wanted to make you laugh. And you kind of mentioned that Arrested Development was still able to hit some emotional points without pushing too hard and without kind of switching over into the maudlin aspects of it. But if you look at certain other sitcoms that you could compare Arrested Development to in terms of its goals, Seinfeld is probably the biggest one, and you mentioned that, as far as being a show that was 100% concerned about being funny, not concerned at all about sentimentality. And do you think that the early episodes of Arrested Development established that, or do you think that it kind of became more and more like Seinfeld as it went? And I guess another way to ask that question is, do you think that the cynicism of Seinfeld went a little too far, and Arrested Development maybe was able to mitigate that by establishing this early emotional core? Or do you think that they're just both kind of doing their own thing and both equally valid?
Yeah, I think both equally valid. You know, Seinfeld, and it had a very, I think, clear mission statement. And also, Seinfeld is, for the most part, certainly very episodic. You know, things were one and done. You can pick it up at any time. And I think by the nature of Arrested Development having these season-long, if not series-long, plot threads playing out, you know, by nature of that, you kind of need a little bit more time with the characters and somewhat more of the sentimentality to really hook you onto the story as a whole. So I think, you know, what worked for Seinfeld, and what worked for Arrested Development certainly worked for Arrested Development.
Do you guys think, and I'll go to Justin, do you guys think that Arrested Development, in the end, is as cynical about its characters as a Larry David show is? Or do you think that it's kind of remained, the affection has remained even as it's been less overt in later episodes? Justin, go ahead.
That's an interesting question to ask after these 15 episodes did some, like, unexpectedly deep character development on people. And I think it's also hard to answer in a series that I think was specific, or season, I'm sorry, I was over in Foggy London Town. Yeah. A season that left everybody at like a near lowest point, and I think there's a redemption arc coming up for them, whether it's another season or a movie or whatever's supposed to conclude all the plans in motion that we just saw. I think it gets darker, and I think there's some cruelty there, but I think there is supposed to be some affirming stuff about, you know, they're better together than better apart, and it's the one son who had no choice but to keep them all together. I think that's a positive thing you're supposed to view, even when you're dealing with these oblivious, narcissistic, cynical, greedy, etc. people.
Well, I think there's an interesting through line in a lot of TV commentary online and just in print in general that discusses the kind of the despicableness of certain television characters. And it went to Seinfeld, and it's continued with Girls, and certainly Arrested Development and other shows of that ilk, where you say, oh, well, how are we supposed to like these characters? They're so disgusting. And to me, it seems oddly judgmental to a degree that I don't quite understand, because while a lot of these characters are selfish, self-centered, certainly on Seinfeld, you know, they're shown to be that way at the end of the series, at no point, even looking at it critically, do I consider any of them to be completely loathsome. You know, they sometimes have schemes, but nobody certainly is killing anybody. Nobody is being extremely malicious. And certainly that's true on Arrested Development, too. You know, you have actual criminal activity on Arrested Development and greed, but they still show some degree of caring for each other. So I don't really see what a lot of people see as far as the despicableness and heinous or heinosity, I don't know what the word is, for these characters. Do you guys see their Arrested Development, or the Bluths, I guess I should say, as completely hateable, despicable characters, or do you think that even judging them by real person standards, there are redemptive qualities to each of them? Albert?
Yeah, I think definitely, and I think, you know, to touch on Justin's point a few moments ago, I think that season four, as dark as it gets, kind of underscores that. And I think, you know, for as weird of places as all the main characters go in the fourth season, I think there's also effort clearly being made to show that they each have qualities that are either redemptive or likable or relatable. And I think just in general, the idea that of likableness with TV characters, I think, can be a very limiting thing. Like, that's subjective, and it's also, you know, do you have to, like, is it really that important? You know, like, if someone's entertaining, do they have to be likable? And I think with Seinfeld and all the way to Arrested Development, their characters aren't necessarily unlikable or certainly not loathsome. I think they're presented often as over the top as these shows can get in more realistic ways, as, you know, more people sometimes are selfish and act in their own self-interest and make frustrating decisions, certainly is something we see a lot in Arrested Development. And to me, that's kind of more relatable, as, you know, broadly drawn as some of these characters can sometimes be.
Yeah, I think there's at least the groundwork being laid for an interesting turn where at the end of this season, Lucille says something about how she's thought about it and she's not sure she wants to play the villain, at the same time that there are ominous things going on in the background that seem to be setting the stage for either Lucille Ostero or Sally Sitwell or the Sitwell family to be the antagonists, which is not something the show has really had before that. And then it will actually have this rooting interest in the Bluth family, but that's kind of speculative.
That's actually an interesting point. And I was actually thinking, people, going back to what Albert said about likability, people seem to have higher standards for likability of television characters than they do for people in their own lives. I certainly think that's true as far as the characters on a show like Girls go. As far as these characters, no one's really doing anything that terrible. And I think Arrested Development, that's not quite as true. People are doing things that are a little bit more terrible. But assuming that these characters were some semblance of human beings, Justin, do you consider them to be completely despicable people? Do you consider Job to be 100% irredeemable as a human being?
Well, some of the stuff neglectful things he does with, like, his son and Anne, you do start to feel bad for them. But they're also, like, extremely vulnerable people. And, you know, it's not like you could do a biography of him that explains and justifies all of that. But at least in a heightened comedy situation, I think they're all rootable characters. Especially someone like Tobias just seems like the sweetest, most oblivious person. And, also pretty sympathetic in that he frequently gets run over by cars and things like that. So, yeah, different shades. If we went through people one by one, I don't know, some of them are worse than others. One of the most jarring things, I think, about this season was how compromised Michael had gotten, which I think was a little hard for some people to take, considering while far from perfect, he was always, like, the center of the show. And a guy who made the best of things. So, yeah, I think they play around with that a little bit. It depends on what you want to land on.
And going back to what you said about Michael, the first season especially has Michael as the emotional core and the sane one, so to speak. There's certainly some madcap adventures he gets into, such as lying to the blind attorney, who is also lying, but showing that he has some degree of schemingness to him, but always with that center of, oh, he's doing this for the family. As far as the first season goes and its structure, to me, the moment where the first season, and this was also based a part on my viewing experience and watching that marathon that kind of got me hooked on the show, the point where the first season really turns into something that seems to have a really remarkable degree of staying power is the peer pressure episode. And Justin, do you remember the story behind how that episode was created?
Yeah, I think the lore is that it was a note from Fox about how suggestions for more relatable plots, like maybe George Michael could learn a nice lesson from his father. Or no, maybe Michael could teach his son a nice lesson, I think is how they phrased it. And that's what they ran with.
As far as jokes in the show's history, I think the one joke that was most perfectly built to, or the one line, I should say, to receive maximum laughter and kind of catharsis was the that's why you don't teach lessons to your son line. Because I clearly remember being in a room watching this this marathon with a bunch of my friends in college, and the entire room exploded with laughter at that point. And it kind of showed, even in a smaller scale, since the joke was built during that one episode as opposed to over the course of many episodes, but that building to those jokes really adds to the payoff. And I think that they kind of learn that lesson to such a degree that now in the fourth season, there are jokes that really you are set up in the first episode and don't pay off until the 13th, 14th, 15th episode.
There are jokes that aren't even jokes until you watch it through the season a second time.
That's absolutely true. And Albert, do you think that structure of paying off jokes much, much later has uniquely bolstered Arrested Development's reputation, or do you think that there are maybe other shows that do that similarly well?
I definitely don't think that a show does it with the same type of ambition and type of long-term planning that Arrested Development has done it. And, you know, I think it's definitely unique in that way, and I think, you know, that's what's made it so special.
There are shows that, I'm sorry if I cut you off. I think there are shows that have a lot of affection for their, like, catalog of jokes. 30 Rock would bring things back.
Yeah.
But I don't think it was, you know, written ahead of time. And same thing with Community, where maybe it's just that the internet is and TV criticism, he said in italics, has become so much more pervasive than when Arrested was on the air. And there, you know, you get a lot of more information and interviews with showrunners and things like that. Showrunners talking about filling their schedules and making these 22 episodes on a network schedule, it just sounds so chaotic, and episodes being written on the fly, thrown out, revised, whatever. It's not, I don't know how chaotic it was when they were doing this show. I know Hurwitz has talked about how little time he spent with his family and things like that, but even thinking back, I have no idea how it was even possible to put this stuff together. It's just a big blueprint. I know we heard about his master plan for this year that ran all across the walls of the writer's room and things like that, but it seems pretty unprecedented. And another, from a technical thing that I won't pretend to understand, had something to do with how they were, the new style of shooting the show meant they could take all this digital footage and accumulate it in a bunch of different locations, but that's all I'll say about that, because that's all I understand about that.
So moving along from the first season to the second season of Arrested Development, things started to get a little bit more chaotic, and I think characters, especially, and I'll go back to Lindsay, really changed in tone to a degree. Do you feel that the second season elevated the show from where it was in the first season, or do you think it just took it in a different, equal direction? Albert?
Yeah, I would say elevated, just because the world became richer and there just became, you know, more of the elements that we all kind of love about the show got introduced in the second season, and just you got to meet more characters and different jokes that were developed that, you know, became a huge part of the show's lore. And, you know, I think it was a good season.
Justin, how would you compare the first two seasons to each other?
Yeah, there's a certain point, like 6 or 7 episodes into the second season, where Tobias's accidental picture of his testicles very nearly leads to the invasion of Iraq or some other nemesis of the era. And at that point, you kind of said, things are a little bit different here. I think it became more of a live-action cartoon, whereas the first season was more grounded in reality and real people talking to each other. But there's some pretty great cartoons, and this was one of them. I think there also is, a point where early on in that season, through the rest of the original run, some characters like Lindsay and Tobias, every plot they have and most of the jokes around them are about one thing. With Lindsay, it's about trying to have sex with different men. With Tobias, it's about him not knowing he's gay. And I guess maybe once she takes the studio job, almost everything she does is about that. And that's one of the cool things about this new season is they broaden those kinds of characters in a way I wouldn't have imagined. Like Lindsay's arc, where she completely abandons her activist roots and decides that she's actually been a conservative all along, and she's more like her mother than she ever expected. That's surprisingly compelling work.
Absolutely. Now, as far as besides just the development of the characters, there was also a development in the joke structure. Like we said, it certainly became more cartoonish, but there was also way more self-referentiality to the jokes, and the layers of wordplay got much more creative and became much more essential to the comedy in the show beginning in the second season. Certainly that was present in the first season, but things like, you know, very early on in the second season, there was a scene where they were unveiling the new houses for the Booth Company, and there was a scissor, someone with a scissor and someone with a rock attacking each other, and then it was all covered by the paper. Mm-hmm. And puns became this essential element to Arrested Development. And where do you think that wordplay falls on the list of things that really made the show what it is, Justin? I ask you as the punniest guy I know.
It certainly delights me. Yeah, there's a joy to that. I don't know if it's universal, but yeah, especially in that the second season, it seems to ramp up. I think there also, it's there in the first, there's like a literal evocation of cliches. I know things like the entire Cornballer episode was written backwards from finding a reason for Michael to say, "That's a little cornball." To, again, like we brought up before, undercut like a touching father-son conversation. I think the episode after that, was written backwards from having a reason for Job's girlfriend to tell his brother that he's been stabbed in the back, which he literally had. And then that carries through the second one. Although, I also wonder how much changeover Gesundheit in writing staffs happened, and whether, you know, when you get to a point where fans of the show become writers on the show, and then they want to, you know, consciously recreate that and work really hard. And I think I read somewhere that at a certain point, it just became a challenge for the staff to amuse themselves, to come up with the most audacious puns possible, and then just use all of them, because anything, any set, any still shot in Arrested can be made a joke, and so plenty of room to fit all that stuff in. So you have the dueling restaurants in the Maggie Leiser Part 2 arc of, what is it, Skip Churches and Miss Temples.
Miss Temple.
Mm-hmm.
Albert, do you think that that puns and wordplay are kind of one of the essential ingredients to the Arrested Development mix? And do you think, as somebody who knows a lot about TV, do you think there are other shows that can kind of match wits with Arrested Development when it comes to wordplay?
You know, I've never seen it, but I remember reading a lot at the time people comparing Arrested Development's sort of wordplay and dialogue style to Police Squad. I don't know if that's true, but I remember people making that comparison. And I think it's definitely a vital part of the formula, you know, down to the fact that the episode titles are such puns. And, you know, I remember season 2 starting with, like, the first couple episodes were, like, Friends-type episode names, or it was the one blank, and then the third episode was called Amigos. Just, like, you know, I mean, who would even know what the episode titles were? And the fact that they, you know, put so much effort into that. And, you know, the one, I think, where Tobias takes that inadvertent picture of his testicles is called Sad Sack.
Mm-hmm.
And just stuff like that is, you know, it's obviously, I think it just shows the amount of thought put into it, and also, you know, just sort of a genuine affection for wordplay.
It's a show so filled to the brim with comedy that they stick it in the titles too. And then this, unless, you know, I guess the credits didn't really run when they were on TV, they would be shrunk into a corner for an ad for, the next Joe Millionaire, probably. But this season has gotten to the point where they're putting jokes in the credits, like in we're doing full-on hard spoilers, right?
Sure.
So when characters are in disguise in earlier episodes, like when Maybe plays the shaman is credited in the credits, obviously, as something like Rich Aaliyah and Ost, which is a jumbled up Aaliyah and an ostrich. So, and then there's another point in whatever the title is about the switch, something like that, where instead of directed by Mitch Hurwitz and Troy Miller, it says directed by Troy Miller and Mitch Hurwitz, and all kinds of little. So, really working that pause button in a way that even before, when DVRs were around, but, you know, it wasn't a guarantee that everyone was watching them on a computerized device. It's like, yeah, have at it, you sons of bitches. You wanted it, you got it.
And another interesting thing about the episode titles is just the fact that the timing happened to be so perfect for when the show came out. It was just the time that websites were being created to completely compile every aspect of the show, every joke, every line, every shot that could be analyzed. And it gave people the opportunity to actually, like you said, see what the episode's titles were. You know,
right.
If the show had come out in 1993, you know, most people didn't even have a cable system that gave descriptions of the show that where anyone would ever even find out the episode title. So it was really kind of a serendipitous thing where the technology allowed for the jokes to be denser than they had ever been.
Yeah, I mean, listen to what you just said. You had to wait to watch a marathon on FX to get your first taste of the show. You couldn't just fire it up and watch it, or steal it, or however you wanted to do it.
I mean, I could have, but I'm not that kind of person.
Couldn't download it from iTunes.
Not iTunes, but What existed in 2003, 2004? Kazaa?
I don't know. I guess, yeah. I do remember that there were like shows that you could download back then, because I have a very specific memory of a season 6 Buffy the Vampire Slayer episode that was leaked online a week early, which would have been early 2002, which looking back now, it seems impossible that early on that anyone would A, bother to put something online back then, or B, that, you know, it was even possible, but it was. It blew my mind.
Well, I could download Arrested Development episode 2 from Kazaa, and it could either be a poorly... either be a poorly encoded version of an Usher song, or be just some general gay porn, or, you know, straight porn, one of those.
Regular sex.
One of those sex videos that they have all the time.
If you typed Arrested Development into Kazaa, so many Arrested Development songs would come up.
Yeah, Tennessee.
Slightly misspelled so that they would not be shut down.
But as far as I know, none of their songs were called Episode 1 or Episode 2.
Well, very, very big on punning their song titles, too. So.
And not to harp on episode titles, but I think a lot of shows do that now and have done that since Arrested Development with punny episode titles.
Bro, Gossip Girl?
Right?
Matt knows what we're talking about.
I do not. So another thing that Arrested Development started doing in season 2 especially, and I guess probably did it in season 1, but really ratcheted up in season 2, was it became very cruel to its characters. And the most obvious example, as Albert talked about in his article, is Buster's hand being bitten off by a loose seal. First of all, another pun right there, but also, like you said, a very, very dark plot turn for a major character in anything, and especially in a comedy such as this. And at no point did the show attempt to get you to really have a great deal of sympathy for Buster or feel emotion about it, other than, oh, that's hilarious. Can you guys think of other examples of the show being very mean to its characters, and what are the implications of that storytelling approach?
Well, I feel that Tobias was near death for a lot of season 3. Literally. And, you know,
which
everyone was
fine with, because right, they were getting some attention from it.
And, you know, and if you really think about it, Tobias and Buster are two of the most sympathetic characters on the show,
mm-hmm,
and they do kind of get knocked around the most. And, yeah, you know, it doesn't necessarily, it is cruel when you look at it sort of, you know, objectively and from a bit of a distance, but I don't know, there's something about the skillful way that all of those things play out in the show that, like, it doesn't feel like too much. It feels like just a normal part of this world that they're able to kind of ramp up to, and, you know, it all sort of makes sense, even though objectively some of it's horrifying.
And something we also talked about before, I think there's like a real sweetness when everyone gathers at the hospital or wherever they were when they mistakenly thought that George Sr. had died, and they're all like, they're in it together before they inevitably regress to their jokes and selfish interests and whatever their plot for that episode is.
Big Bear.
The tears aren't coming. It's not one of the lines. So.
And I think the last thing that season 2 adds to the legacy of the show is the meta aspects of the joke telling and the plots. Certainly when the news broke of the episode order being cut from 22 episodes to 18 episodes, which, you know, kind of in retrospect doesn't really sound all that bad, but, you know, given what's happened to certain other shows, it sounds like, four fewer episodes, what's the big deal? But at the time, it was a huge controversy to the point where they wrote it into at least one of the episodes and probably more than one. And, you know, that sort of joke writing and storytelling really showed how important the show's cult following was. And you wonder how many people watching the show at that time were fans who didn't follow every piece of minutia on the internet and had no idea what was really going on and how that played to them. And had it already gotten to a point where anybody watching Arrested Development
would pretty much automatically know about all the backstory behind the production of Arrested Development. I'm honestly not sure the answer to that. But, Justin, how do you think that added to the legacy of the show by having its plots and its jokes kind of be a commentary on what the actual production of the show was going through?
Well, that's for sure. It's looking at Community as an antecedent to it is... And should ramp up even more next year. But, I wondered myself, like, is an episode like, which I know is in the next season, SOBs, completely incomprehensible to anyone who didn't know what was going on? And if someone was watching, like, on a random December Monday to see SOBs, how could they not know? Because a lot of it is subtle, and you have to look for it. The story about building 22 houses and dropping them to 18 is more of a wink that gets broadened, and you say, oh, how about that? Which I think is part of the fun of a lot of the jokes on the show. And it did build up a big communal thing where you were, no pun intended, in this together, and we all had this secret thing. I would rewatch episodes from season one, but it wasn't until I was reading other people talk and compile the references that I knew anything about repeated references to Cloudmere vodka or Shirley Fumke banners in the background. So, it's a pretty insular thing, and I think it's a real credit to just how excellent the show was that it transcended all of that narrowness in a way that no other show has, but we are starting to see with some properties like Veronica Mars, where maybe we're just moving into an era where distribution has changed enough that cult stuff can live on.
Now, moving on to season three, which up until about 6 days ago was the most controversial season in the history of the show. They certainly ratchet that up, like you said, that episode SOBs. They ratchet up the fact that the show is a commentary about itself and about television and all that stuff. But there are also a few plot lines that caused a good deal of controversy. Do you feel, Albert, that season three made any major missteps? Or do you think that it worked as well as the other seasons?
I think, we were talking about season two being different. I think in the moment while I was watching season two, I didn't notice it necessarily that much, or at least like kind of wasn't taken aback by it as much. Season three, I definitely did feel a difference, but I still liked it. And I remember, speaking of things being different back then, I actually had all season three episodes on a VHS tape back when those still existed, and I still really liked it, and I think that was probably maybe one of the most ones that I really kind of poured over, because I would like rewatch them all over and over on this one VHS tape, because I managed to get all 13 episodes on one tape, which I feel is impressive. I don't know, maybe I cut the commercials out, which is really nerdy, but that sounds like something I probably would do, because my parents had a
pause button.
Yeah, hit the pause button. My parents had a dual deck VCR, allowing such editing to be possible. But yeah, I think that was also, I think it was sort of a polarizing one where, it's an obvious point, but kind of the appeal of the show, for its dedicated fans also was probably its downfall to mass audiences. And I think that was maybe the season that probably went the most for it until season four. And, but I think it, I think it was fine. We all have seen shows that can really take like weird turns or sort of, kind of betray their own premises or sell their characters out. And I don't necessarily think it did that. I think it was still consistent. It was just ratcheted up that much further.
Well, I think that a lot of the controversy from the third season comes from the early episodes with the storyline about Wee Britton and Rita with Charlize Theron. But before we get to that, I think that one of the things that might also be problematic for a lot of people, as Justin mentioned, is the fact that the later season episodes were so extremely self-referential and insane that it might have become something to where you just could not approach it unless you were deeply, deeply engaged in the story of the show. And there was, of course, SOBs, which was all about trying to save the show, and Ron Howard continually begging people to call people to get them to watch the episode. But there was also the one that played on the peer pressure episode in which all these elaborate lessons were being taught. And you wonder, if would that have been funny if you hadn't seen the original? Does it matter if it would have been funny if you hadn't seen the original? Did things just get too insane during that period for someone to approach it? And is that even important, Justin?
Well, it's... on the whole, I can't. I think it's just too unfair to hold it to the same criteria as the first two seasons, because, like, whatever extent of a master plan they had... in the vein of the first two, had to have been, like, completely blown up almost immediately when they knew they were not long for this world, and it was, well, throw everything out and whatever our break glass in case of emergency plotline wrap-ups. And that they even got to that is kind of remarkable. But, yeah, I think in the early episodes you can see long-term planning. I know that Tobias... host versus graph thing is set up ahead of time, and then maybe after that point is when things sort of got crazy and Rome was burning, or whatever analogy you want to use. But for sure, I think as soon as we saw that there was a neighborhood called Wee Britain, which was an Americanized version of England akin to Chinatown, where everyone is British and you have to drive on the other side of the road, that was for sure bonkers. I think kind of what was so disorienting about it was that they had to dive right into it because they wanted to get Charlize Theron Oscar winner front and center in an attempt, which is kind of adorable considering how it played out, to get some mainstream attention and sustain the show. I wonder if it had kind of done more grounded episodes that set up the end of season two and sort of took a longer route to get George Sr. in house arrest and a trial and settling all those plot lines with George Michael, and maybe people would have been a little more cool with it.
Do you feel that storyline with Charlize Theron overall was a storyline that worked? Because I feel that it seems, at least in a lot of quarters, that the general consensus after time is that it just did not work. And while, like you said, I was stricken by how insane it all seemed at first when they first introduced that whole plot in one episode, and it certainly wasn't something that they could have done in season one and gotten away with, do you feel that in the end it came together in a way that was satisfying enough to say, okay, that was a plot line that worked for the show? Albert, what were your thoughts on that?
You know, I felt very conscious of that storyline as I was watching it, because I think as it was playing out and the reveal of her, you know, being mentally retarded, I guess I didn't think it was maybe too insane, but I kind of had the feeling that maybe it was a little bit more mean-spirited than some of the humor of the show had been before. And I think that's kind of what I sort of not really had a problem with, but was sort of disoriented by, where it was like, you know, jokes about, you know, mentally disabled people, is this really what it is? But ultimately, I don't really think that's what it was. But I do kind of feel like that was sort of what disarmed me about it. Not necessarily the wackiness of it, just kind of like, oh, you know, this is kind of a different type of turn for the show. But I don't think that it ultimately was what it was. I just kind of, you know, I was like, I don't know, it's kind of some interesting territory that they're delving into.
Taken on the whole, yeah, I mean, for sheer ambition and forethought and hiding of clues, I just marvel at that whole thing.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, maybe I just look at it more from a what they accomplished standpoint than what it all meant at the time. Wee Britain still comes across to me as very weird. The fact that there were suddenly these British spies who were after them maybe doesn't ring as oddly, since if you watch it again, you know, they're not spies at all. They're just some guy and his mentally retarded niece.
Now, one thing, like, because when I watched season three, you know, I certainly felt all of that, but I also kind of reveled in the insanity. I thought that it was insanely fast-paced, and very, very funny. A lot of the individual jokes were funny. But one thing that does strike me about it looking back is that in a lot of cases, I don't remember the jokes as well as I do from the first two seasons because there was so much stuff thrown at the wall and maybe a little bit less consistency. You know, there are certain things that very much stand out. You know, the original sighting of Wee Britain and the Poppins and Graf versus Host and the episode with Justine Bateman for pure insanity. But I think that maybe the lack of planning just by necessity made certain things kind of stick out less than they used to. Overall, as far as season three, do you consider it a level below the other two seasons, or do you consider it just kind of a strange but necessary part of the whole Arrested Development package? I think I pretty much already asked that to Albert. So, Justin, what do you think?
I think I can't hold it the same level just because it, out of their control, they had fewer episodes to deliver quality jokes and also had to blow through an ending real quickly. I think I still think it's indispensable, even if it's a clear third out of three. I think there's lasting and worthwhile additions to the mythology of the show, like Forget-Me-Nows and things like that, that I feel like had they had the full 22 or even 18, it would be talked about as like a season that took some risks and got even broader and more insane, but is delivered the same amount of quality we all appreciate from the show.
Now, the very last episode, which up until very recently we assumed was literally the very last we'd ever see of those characters again.
Well,
what, and I'll start with Albert, what do you think of that as a finale to the series? Was it satisfying? Did it wrap things up in a logical and satisfactory way? How would you have felt if we, and how did you feel under the assumption that that was it and Arrested Development was over forever?
Well, to back up just like a little bit, I remember part of the panic around Arrested Development Season 2 being cut down to 18 episodes, but I think people also assumed that was going to be it, just because it didn't seem like a good sign that they were cutting
order
at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And
absolutely true, and my apologies for forgetting that.
And I,
who's
so
that?
The fact,
who's the woman from E, or what, Kristen something, put up this report on like 11 o'clock on a weeknight about not just a renewal for season three, but they renewed it for two more seasons, which ended up being a false report. And it, the level of exaltation I felt at that point was, people were invested in this in a big way. I think you lose sight of it when you just think of those whole 3 years as a continuum.
Of course,
but please continue.
Kristen Dos Santos.
There we go.
Formerly of Watch with Wanda.
There we go. I knew my man on the inside would help me out.
And, yeah, so in a way, just the fact that there's a season three at all felt like a metaphorical victory lap.
House money.
Yeah. And then also, you know, knowing that they only had 13 episodes, I guess, yeah, you know, I did like the presumptive season finale, series finale. It did, you know, I mean, I wish there was more, but I don't remember at the time, you know, feeling like anything other than I just wish this thing I liked was still going on. I don't think there's a specific, like, this wasn't wrapped up well enough. I think they did as good as they could, given what they had. And, you know, obviously for years and years, despite the fact the near continuous rumors and rumblings and updates that something was going to happen with the property, I think we all, up until this was, Netflix thing was finally officially announced, assumed wasn't really ever going to happen. I would have been fine with it just because that's, you know, the only thing we could have expected. But, yeah, I mean, I wanted more, but I think they did a good job. I think that last episode of season three did well, for sure.
I think also they compressed a whole lot of stuff about, like, Lindsay's heritage and An Young pulling strings and whatnot that they just threw all into one 22-minute episode, which would have been really rewarding to see play out naturally over how long they wanted to play it. I love parallels and things like that, so the fact that they did a mirror of the pilot really appealed to me. Although I could never live with it as closure, if only because the line they chose to make the final words uttered in the series, where I call forward to a movie, to where I felt like they had to do something else just to pay off the last joke in their last episode.
And a weird thing about the finale as it aired was the last four episodes all aired on the same day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's
so
a great joke.
I still sort of associate them all kind of together. So I think that made it even seem more kind of compressed and fast-paced with everything they threw in there towards the end.
It was very confusing watching the Season 3 DVD why two of the last four episodes had abbreviated credits. And then I was like, oh yeah, because they aired all at once and didn't want to show the credits over and over again. But there's a great joke in the fourth season where they all... go to the, I guess, police station after the Queen Mary wrecks, and John Beard is on the news saying the opening ceremonies of the 2006 Winter Olympics deliver record ratings. I'd hate to be their competition.
I did not actually even notice that until you brought it up to me. What's interesting about that finale is there were certain strands that were kind of barely picked up on in season four, and one of them was the Lindsay being adopted aspect that they mentioned, and it seemed like if they go forward with more episodes, they'll come back to it, because there was the scene where Lucille tells Lindsay, oh, you're a Bluth. And the other one was Anyang somehow being responsible for their downfall, and they really pretty much didn't mention that at all in the new season. Do you think that things would have been better if they had kind of tried to touch on all the loose ends as they came back for these new episodes, or do you think that it really wasn't that important, Albert?
I think they touched on a lot, and I think one of the great triumphs of season four is the amount of callbacks they were able to work in there, which I think is something that, you know, everyone wanted to see, obviously, but they didn't do it in a way that just felt like fan service. It just wasn't there just to be there. I feel like they were weaved in pretty organically. And also, you know, you got to keep in mind that even though it was 15 episodes and some of them were quite lengthy, you know, it still played over, you know, a short period of time. So I think to try to cram everything in there for what season four was would have been not really rang true. It would have been too much.
The only thing to me it felt like it really walked back was I always just envisioned that Michael and George Michael, with their unexpected guests, sailed off to whatever that island was and spent some time there. And that was the one thing where it seemed like they said, well, that's not really going to work. So they turned around immediately. Though that does parallel everything Michael had done up to that point, even if it was sold in that episode as the time he finally walked away.
Now, with season four, originally when it was first announced, the idea right from the start was that it was going to be a prologue for an eventual Arrested Development movie. Does it still seem that way to you guys after watching it? And do you think that's how it works best? Justin, what do you feel about that whole kind of conceit behind the season?
As a prologue or the future of it beyond this season?
As a prologue to some has to the real thing.
Oh, okay. We assume there's going to be something else, and then just as this works at it. Yeah, I almost have to think of it similar to season three in that we didn't necessarily need to have this. It's like a Lord of the Rings appendix about that, like explains all of the shit that went on with kings and whatever wars that happened before the events of the book, and they filmed it and they wrote it and they made all these episodes. They could have just jumped in with probably minimal exposition about whatever they want to do for all of the post Cinco de Cuatro stuff, and instead we got if you can accept that they're different than the original show, just these bonus explorations of these characters that filled in a world for 6 years to get them to that point.
And going by that, the fact that it sort of is a bonus thing and it's a lot of exposition, it seems like a lot of people had a reaction to the show, even those who liked it, that started out by saying, okay, this is strange, and I don't know if I like it. And then just suddenly at some moment, the bigger picture revealed itself. And whether that worked for you or not, you know, depends on the person. But how did you feel, Albert, when you first were watching, let's say, the first three or four episodes?
You know, I noticed that, as a lot of people have noted, the pacing is different. Obviously, you know, going from like 21-minute episodes to, at some cases, what's the longest? Probably like 37, around there, which is almost, you know, the length of a TV drama, the likes of like a Dr. House type program. And I, for the most part, I like that. I think that the jokes had more room to breathe in a way that not only we hadn't seen in Arrested Development before, but you don't really see in TV comedies. And that's pretty clear right from the first episode with all of the various antics involving Michael living in the dorm with his son and his fruitless attempts to try to vote out P-Hound. And, you know, I can see how people would be disoriented by it, and I think I probably was a little bit. But, you know, it sort of, at the same time, I felt like it looked very similar to how it looked before, like sort of the visual style didn't seem dramatically different to me. I feel like, you know, the musical cues, the narration, I felt like pretty much all of the actors seem to slip very well back into their characters, despite not having played them in 7+ years.
Whatever oddness would have occurred to me because of the difference in pacing and stuff was, I think, overwhelmed by the fact that I just couldn't believe I was watching new things with these characters
right.
for the first time in so many years. And also that they had suddenly, like, it wasn't just referential. They had added so much new to the mythology, new phrases, new jokes, new situations, new relationships, to where it never really even occurred to me, oh, this is different, because I was just in awe of the fact that it seemed from very early on, wow, they really did put a lot of thought and detail into this. Like you said, this isn't just fan service. This is a whole new thing that is going to be memorable. So, like, the whole idea that, oh, all the characters aren't interacting, this is the pacing is different, it really didn't occur to me. Justin, how did you feel about the early episodes of the show?
I think everybody's reaction has been kind of charmingly mirrored, to where you start out confused and saying this is not quite right, and then maybe 4 or 5 in you start to get it, and then around 10, 11, 12... not to paint everybody with the same brush, but you're thinking, this is pretty amazing. And if I hadn't read it over and over and over again, I wouldn't speak for everybody like that. But so it, I don't know if they necessarily designed it to where the first couple episodes just there wasn't a way to make them work, or if they envisioned it as like a circular thing. Certainly they were taking risks and opportunities at the same time with the new format, when really what impresses me so much is it would have been so easy just to do 9 or 10 straightforward-esque episodes with a lot of callbacks. And again, not wanting to paint everybody with the same brush, I think people have internalized those first 53 episodes so much because it was all you had to watch for 6 years, and it, you know, grew in notoriety and popularity and in the time it's been gone, in the great dark ages, as they call it in the show. Like, that's all you know. So you know that vocabulary, and you want to speak in that vocabulary, which for Arrested Development was such a big part of the show, was knowing the language. And then when you get this stuff and can't speak it anymore, it's like, wait, this is not my thing. Give me back my thing.
Yes, and I think among the criticisms, and I think probably it's a good place to start with season 4 is to talk about the criticisms, among the big ones are that it seems to some people that maybe Mitch Hurwitz didn't do what he really wanted to do because he couldn't get all the actors together, and so he had to settle for this crazy puzzle in which all the characters are kind of on their own and cross paths every once in a while, and this is really kind of not an ideal situation for even him, and so it wasn't an ideal situation for the viewer. Do you think that the fact that the characters couldn't interact to the degree that they could before was a big hindrance on the show? Do you think that it was an unfortunate thing that they worked around, or do you think that it might have actually possibly, maybe, enhanced things by making this a brand new and different experience? Albert?
You know, I think this is one of those situations where what you read about in advance colors your expectations so much, because we had heard for so long that each episode is going to focus on one individual character that I think my expectations for that were more extreme than it actually ended up being. Because there is a good amount of interaction between the characters throughout. It's maybe not exactly what it was, but, you know, at first when you hear, oh, it's going to focus, you know, on one character, you think that that might literally be true. And, it's, you know, like for the maybe episode, you're only going to see me, maybe. But, you know, other people drop in and out fairly commonly, regularly. And I think given that, I guess maybe just because I was expecting something more dramatic, that I was like, okay, this is fine. You know, this is a good amount of interaction. This seems to work. And obviously, you know, plot-wise, the fact that they were all sort of doing different things was an important part of the story. So, you know, I guess my expectations were kind of lowered or at least altered. So by actually seeing it, I was like, oh, okay, this makes sense. This is fine. This is a good amount of interaction.
And Justin, how would you react to that?
Yeah, I think also thematically it plays into it in that, you know, they were all divided at the end of season three with that accident and went their separate ways. And this is the story that finally puts them back together for whether it's another season or the movie. Like, that plays into it that they're all separate and you want them to be reunited. I think I would only consider it a hindrance in the amount of, if you can notice the green screen stuff, then that might be a little bit distracting. But in general, I don't think of, like, the cast limitations. I just think of it as part of the story of the creation of the show, the same way the first three had to accommodate having 21 minutes and probably shrinking every year, and whatever network influence they had on the show and reduced episode orders and things like that. I think they make the best of it and turn it, I can't say into a strength, because I don't know how much they would have liked to have done if they had more availability for people. But, you know, not a detriment. It's one of the criticisms that I've seen is that people miss the ensemble scenes, which I don't really remember it being a big ensemble hangout show where you tuned in to see nine characters in the same room riffing. Like, there are definitely scenes I remember like that that were enjoyable, but everyone was always off doing their own weird thing in, like, five-plus plots per episode, and then they would intersect or converge in surprising ways, which is exactly how the season of this structure, as Albert just said, plays out. It's just 15 chapters of one gigantic episode.
Yeah, they were divided from the start with, obviously, with Jeffrey Tambor, you know, George being in jail, you know?
And even to go further with that, I'm not going to say what, you know, how things would have been better or worse had the circumstances been different, but just for me personally, I can't imagine being as impressed with something that was more similar to the pacing of the original. I can't imagine being more impressed with that than I was with this extended puzzle structure, because this was something that was so new. One of the things that I said before the season, premiered, I always thought that, okay, Arrested Development was something that I was content with letting just lay because I loved it. It was not perfect, but still perfect. And I was okay with it just being that was Arrested Development. Let it be as it was so I can remember it as this exquisite, amazing thing that, you know, changed my sense of humor, you know, all this stuff, changed television. And so I wasn't the most enthusiastic person for these new episodes, but at the same time, I still said, okay, you know, I'm sure they'll still be funny. Well, the one thing they will not be is groundbreaking. And somehow they managed to be incredibly groundbreaking just in terms of the storytelling structure and the way, like you said, they made this a 7.5 hour episode or 8 hour episode that was in some ways paced the way one 22 minute episode used to be, in the sense of characters coming in and out of each other's lives. But the puzzle structure of it kind of made it this brand new thing. And I can understand maybe if somebody doesn't get as turned on by that as, you know, as I would be or as I was, but I still think that the idea that this was kind of a half-baked thing, that they couldn't do it right, because that's,
definitely a criticism. And I think Alan Sepinwall, who's a critic that I enjoy reading, said, you know, if they had brought it back, then I wish they could have just done it right. And the concept that this was somehow not done right or not done in an intentional way or deliberate way and not what it was dreamed to be, that just seems extremely wrong-headed to me because it seems so intricately and thoughtfully created. What do you guys think of the new structure and how it adds to the legacy or doesn't? Justin?
Yeah, I think it fits right into the narrative of Triumph that people who really like Arrested Development like to congratulate it and probably to some extent themselves for liking it. I thought I was done being impressed by the people behind it, and then to have this, the whole story hasn't even been written because I'm pretty extremely confident that there's at least going to be something more, you know, whether it's another season like this or a movie or even just a long episode in the form of a movie that they put on Netflix. I know they sort of walked back the idea that it was made for binge watching, but I think it, just in the sense of like those are long episodes and it's hard to like enjoy them fully if you watch a bunch in a row, but these episodes, you think of how we watch TV on the internet now, where like every episode gets a review, which is really just a paraphrase of what happened, and then some thoughts from the author. Then you make some quotes about it, then you go off in the comments and debate things. If some of these episodes had come out on a weekly basis, like I can't imagine what kind of meltdown, even compared to the one that happened from the earlier reviews, if that first episode came out and stood alone by itself. I think people would have just been like apoplectic about what is happening, how can this happen? And there really are pieces of a whole and not a sequence, and all the way to the point where it, maybe not binge watching, but definitely repeat watching, it's almost designed to where you just start it over again and keep going, which I'm sure Netflix appreciates. The story is told in like a circle where this mystery at the end of the 15th episode is more or less, at least on the surface, explained at the beginning of the first episode. I don't know if it's designed to be a roofie circle of a series, but it definitely feels that way. Like, you take the roofie right before the first credits of the first episode, and then you have to relearn all this stuff.
Now, Albert, in some ways, the reaction to this almost mirrors back to kind of how Arrested Development kind of should be accepted by people, in the sense that early on, it was kind of embraced by a very small but enthusiastic community of people, and most other people just kind of didn't get it. And maybe this sounds snobbish to say, but I don't really mean it this way, but it almost seems like as the years went on, the kind of the cult and the bandwagon caused other people to push their way kind of on, and now these new episodes are just as maybe alienating as the original ones were to those people who didn't like it in the first place. So now this reaction is sort of mirroring kind of the original reaction people had to the show to begin with. Do you think that kind of holds any water, Albert?
I do, and I think the impressive thing, it's pretty gutsy move, is that obviously we all know that, you know, the intricacies of the show are what made it genius and beloved and also what alienated it to a lot of people. And, you know, coming into season four, they probably could have gone a lot of different directions. They could have opened it up a little bit and made it more welcoming to people who are like, oh, what's this Arrested Development thing? I have Netflix, I'm going to check it out. But instead, I think they doubled down on the intricate nature of it to the point where even some of the show's ardent fans and critics who hailed it in its original incarnation were turned off. But, you know, just sort of proportionately, I think that makes it more admirable and more of an impressive feat.
It's so fun to see them, like, even undercut their own callbacks, like when George Michael teases doing his long-awaited chicken dance and things like that. And the fact that the characters they brought back, you know, people wanted to see more Franklin or Anyang or things like that. They took characters, like Lucille too had a big role, and she actually played kind of surprisingly giant role in this season. But there were people like Ed Helms' character, who only appeared for a couple scenes, who they decided to deepen and broaden rather than just bring back, I don't know, name your person.
And they added brand new characters to mythology, too. I mean, a lot of them in very important roles. Certainly Rebel Alley and Herman Love, or Herbert Love, I should say. Marky Bark and Debris. And, you know, that was one thing that really I would not have expected. They were going to bring in all these new guest stars and give them major, major roles in both the plot and the comedy of the season. And I am sure part of that had to do with just looking at the schedules of the actors and saying, okay, we cannot rely on these people. But the way that they made up for it, I thought, was pretty impressive. And I know a lot of people were not crazy about the Marky character. And certainly I'm actually one of the people who agree with the fact that if Rebel Alley was going to be such a big character, they should have given her more funny to do. But at the same time, I thought that it was just very impressive how willing they were to completely add to this mythology as opposed to just living off their past glories. Justin, what do you think?
Oh, for sure. I mean, even right down to these people's names, it seems like they could have easily inhabited something in season 1 through 3. They would have fit right in. I could see some Dr. Norman going on early on. I guess John Slattery wasn't that big back then, but yeah. The whole story on Rebel and things like that, the gotta wait to see what plates they have spinning in the air and where this all ends up, and who even knows like how beloved, or I guess not beloved, they'll be after the continuation of version 2 of all this stuff.
Now, the other big criticism, or one of the other big criticisms, I should say, is the length of the episodes. And I've read and heard a lot of people saying, well, if you really, in 6 months, got Mitch Hurwitz in a room and made him tell the truth, he would say, these are rough cuts. This is not what I really would have wanted to present to people if I really had all the time in the world in the editing room. I would have wanted to pare this down, made things tighter. You know, some of those scenes with, Joe going shh for a long time, or the vote about the dorm room, or the calling back and forth, Michael and George Michael, about the traffic, that these should have been tightened. These were not the ideal versions of those scenes. And I honestly did not get that sense watching it. I thought that the length added to the humor. I thought it was very much called back to, especially with the Michael vote later in the season, with maybe rolling her eyes at him talking about it. I thought that the length, in most cases, worked just fine. Albert, what do you think about how these episodes were presented lengthwise and pacing-wise? Do you think that they could have benefited from more editing? And do you think that will become the prevailing wisdom as time goes on?
I mean, it seems to be the current consensus, but you know, the troubling thing to me is that there's no real reason why like a television comedy needs to be 21 or 22 minutes. That's just what it's always been because of the conventions of the way that networks work. And since they aren't on one, they're on Netflix, I feel like, you know, they kind of owed it to themselves to explore that episode length and do different things since they weren't within those same constraints. And the fact that they did, even just the fact that they did it, I think is cool and refreshing. And, you know, was it always the most effective choice? You know, I would have to probably rewatch it again to see, but the fact that they exploited the freedom, and I think a lot of times, you know, it did pay off to give some of the jokes more room to breathe, and they didn't have to, you know, rely on that sort of conventional format that, you know, it makes sense to explore that and see what they can do with it.
Justin, do you think there were scenes that should have been tighter or shorter?
Should have been? That was an impression. Not of you. A reference to the show. The show we're talking about. Well, length is, and how you enjoy an episode, to me, is subjective, but I would reject the idea that the episodes are padded. If anything, there's too much stuff that, you know, they enjoy too much to cut. There's, you know, as Albert said, our internal comedy clock is kind of tuned to 21 hours, unless you're watching the BBC Office, and then it's, what, like 30 minutes straight through? But I've only seen half of it a second time, and you definitely notice it at first, especially when you creep over to the 30-minute mark. You're like, wow, this is still going. Also, I don't know how much of that was colored from rapidly trying to marathon through the first three seasons before May 28th or whatever day they came out. I think some of the crankiness of the reviews did come from guys, again, not wanting to paint everybody with the same brush, but force-feeding these eight complex hours of TV in a format that's designed to deepen on repeat viewings, and so there was kind of a lack of sleep, maybe you could read in them. And even myself, I felt compelled to get through them all quickly before someone else from God's internet could spoil it for me. So I really think this is something that's going to reveal more of its wonders over, like, weeks to come. And I think the narrative is going to change in the long run.
Yeah, and speaking of revealing the wonder of it in weeks to come, that's kind of, you know, we were talking about reviews. That kind of bugged me to see, like, you know, on Monday or Tuesday, reviews of the season as a whole with, like, a letter grade assigned to it, like an absolute judgment, where it's like, you know, obviously, you know, because I don't, you know, it wasn't released to critics beforehand. Obviously, that's watched in a very short time period. And to cram all those together that quickly and then to assess it as a whole that quickly, I can understand why, you know, the natures of internet news that has to happen, but I don't think that is the best way to look at this season. And I think I still feel like I don't have a totally full opinion formed yet.
Mm-hmm. There was I think it was like Monday, the Huffington Post said, like, why Arrested Development is the greatest disappointment of the decade.
Right.
It's like, are you sure? Like, do you really want to go with that? I know no one has a legacy now because you can just change whatever and you don't have to stand by anything you say, but I don't know. Some of those early responders are not as heroic as I associate early responders with.
Well, also, given the Huffington Post's propensity to put misleading headlines on their front page that are actually completely different from the headline of the actual article, it is possible that it could have just been talking about, like, the band Arrested Development.
Yeah, the article is actually about season two of Veep.
Yeah.
If you had said that in a Ron Howard voice, I could see that being a plot point in the next season. Given the website's misleading headlines, Michael...
It might say, you know, some critic obliterates Arrested Development, and then he's just like, well, this wasn't as good as I hoped it would be. Yeah, so, well, we really stuck it to the Huffington Post just there. Another thing that the season did, for better or for worse, it definitely did give us more time with characters that we wouldn't have gotten time with in the past, and kind of give characters a chance to kind of live and die on their own. And I think probably completely expectedly, Job really did do a great job holding up his own episodes, as I think he's probably the consensus of funniest character of the series. I think the ones that really surprised people in how well their episodes held up on their own were, well, maybe especially, and to a lesser extent, George Michael. But I think Maybe's episode was kind of a revelation for just how much work has been put into that character that maybe we didn't realize. What did you guys think about the pluses and minuses of each character and their ability to kind of support 30 minutes of comedy on their own, or, you know, primarily on their own? Albert, and then Justin.
As it should be. I think it worked for sure. And I think you're right about Maybe. I mean, I haven't done a rewatch thoroughly. I rewatched a couple episodes here and there before season four started. But, you know, I don't feel like we really ever saw Maybe as a main character nearly as much as in that one episode. And, you know, it felt, even though it was, you know, season four of something that I love so much, it felt like a new thing. Like, it felt like kind of a revelation. It did feel like something I didn't expect from the show. And obviously, yeah, the Job ones were great. And, you know, to digress a little bit, I think, you know, one of the most impressive things about the season is that, you know, the places and positions, no pun intended, that a lot of the characters end up in, if you were just to hear about it, like, you would say that's not going to work. Like, if you heard, you know, in season four of Arrested Development, Tobias is a sex offender, and Job has sex with Tony Wonder, and Lindsay is a prostitute for a Herman Cain-like political candidate, and, you know, Buster is a drone pilot, you'd be like, that sounds terrible. That sounds like
just
a real, like,
fiction.
You know, yeah. But it's all done in such an elegant way that is a natural extension of the character. Like, Tobias, you know, becoming a sex offender, you could interpret that in many ways just hearing about that. But the way it plays out makes perfect sense with how the character has always been presented. And I think that's one of the biggest achievements of this season.
It's vintage. And I think it not only stays true to them, but also deepens them at the same time.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the subtext of Joe being having, like, some homosexual inklings has been sort of there, but then to take him into, like, such a lonely, dark place, and that's where he ends up, it's really endearing to me how much thought Mitch Hurwitz put into not just the show and the plots, but his nine characters as people. I'm like, that's a guy who knows these people. Even, like, as I said before, characters who would become sort of one note and would regress to one defining quality for the purpose of the comedy of the episode. Maybe especially, like, halfway through the run of the series, most of her plots become about just her being a studio exec and kind of like some satirizing Hollywood and the industry that we're all in. And then so you explore her and, like, what it actually means to grow up as maybe Funke and nature versus nurture and this girl as she ages is incredibly compelling. And I think it's like this triumphant moment at the end when the narrator says that she was going to admit that she made a huge mistake and she's, no, I'll be fine. I'm just like, yes! What a wonderful person.
She was the one who got away without becoming a full bloof.
Mm-hmm.
In a sense, not completely tarnished by the self-consciousness and insanity of the rest of the group.
Yeah, whereas conversely, like, George Michael embraces his Bluth towards the end of his arc.
Speaking of these characters, Michael has been a controversial figure. As far, and you kind of touched on that earlier. Michael is now much more pitiful, much more desperate, not as helpful, sort of strikes out on his own and kind of embraces that to a degree. What do you think of how Michael was portrayed in this season? Because there are two sides to it. Either they took Michael out of his natural role, they took the emotional core and the heart out of the show, or this is who Michael always was. He's no longer in the position to where he's wrangling all these worse people, so he doesn't get to be play the morally superior figure. And we've seen signs of this Michael many, many times throughout the history of the series in the context of his interactions with other characters. Is this Michael, or is this a new Michael? Does it matter? Justin.
Something tells me that at the resolution of Act 2 and 3 of this story, it will... Yeah, it's not just going to be, like, a despicable Michael. I think, you know, it's clearly been designed that he's given into his worst impulses and he's been separated away from all the things that, you know, made him be the rootable, if imperfect, Michael that was the protagonist of the series. I mean, the first episode is about him imposing on George Michael, and then the season ends with George Michael punching him. So I think the work on him as the main character is definitely by design. Whether you find it, like, too sad or frustrating, I guess is up to you. But I like the work that's being put into it.
Albert.
Yeah, and I think it makes sense for a couple different reasons. Obviously, part of what made Michael was him in contrast with these more ridiculous characters, and by the nature of the season, he's not always around those characters. And, you know, we've seen him by himself be kind of a dope before. And then when we see him in season four, at times with Lindsay or Job or whoever, you see that old Michael come out. And I think also you can, you know, connect a pretty easy dot and say that just after his experience of everything that's happened to these characters and him being more entrenched with his wacky family members, that would have an effect on him as well, cumulatively. So I think it all made sense, although it is sort of disarming at first. And in terms of Michael's obliviousness. I loved the scene in Ron Howard's office with him and Tobias there, where Tobias is actually less oblivious about Rebel being Ron Howard's daughter than Michael is. That to me seemed like a nice sort of role reversal and kind of a triumphant moment for Tobias, where like I think maybe in the first time in the history of the show he actually is more in on something than another character is, and the fact that it's Michael is the one that he's more in on it than really was kind of a neat moment and just a funny scene in general.
Oh, also the same way is there's the brilliant structure where they have the scene in the penthouse. They're what, preparing for Lucille's trial or something like that, and then every episode or so you pull back and reveal that there's another character sitting around. And so by the end of it, and it's established early on that that's when Michael gets fed up, as he has so many times, and tells them all to, you know, he's done, forget it, you're bad people. Ultimately, you find out everybody was there for George Michael's birthday party. They were kind of having a nice time. They do this really nice thing for him, and then terrible Michael comes in and ruins it.
But it wasn't actually his birthday party, right? It was his going to...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
they just
thought
it was his birthday party.
Right.
No, it's actually funny, that scene, because it kind of had the parallel where you slowly realize that everyone is there, and then the Lucille trial where you slowly realize no one is there. Mm-hmm. And kind of... like that whole structure... I thought had a number of rewards, and I think, you know, to pick an obvious one, I think the biggest one for me as far as the puzzle and slow reveal structure is the fake block storyline, because from the very beginning and for then 12 straight episodes, we fully believe that's a real piece of software that George Michael is creating, maybe not successfully, but trying to create. And then
it sort of,
all of a sudden,
goes along with what Albert said about things seeming like fan fictional dream scenarios, like, oh yeah, George Michael sets up his own social network. I get it. Whatever.
And then, of course, they pull back the layers, and, you know, 6 hours of watching later, you realize, oh, it's just a fake wood block. And by the way, there are a number of programs that really do incorporate a fake woodblock.
Really? But are they as subpar as they accuse them of being?
At least three, right?
To quote my roommate last night, should I download this Cowbell app? It only has three stars.
And even though it only played out over, I guess, 2 episodes, the fact that the first George Michael episode opening, where you think he's like some successful dude because of that, and like
he's
fucking
company.
Up to
this.
Yeah,
he's picked up Tom from the Blues Company.
That, yeah, the reveal of why that's happening was also pretty spectacular.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, other just little subtle aspects to the. I mean, subtle, some subtle, some not so subtle. I know that Justin, you pretty much have a whole list of insane hidden jokes, but the George Maharis thing, which worked completely without this knowledge, but when you find out actually the background of George Maharis and how that plays into other things George Michael said very early in the season, I think that's one of the most clever jokes that the show has ever told, and any show has ever told. And I think that the amount of joy you get out of something being hidden like that probably varies from person to person. But I think for that one, just the degree of cleverness is so impressive that it can't be denied.
Yeah, and I mean, that's part of the joy of having this show back, is you're back into figuring out this stuff or hearing it from someone and getting to pass it on to somebody else. You just, you don't know it's in there, and then when you hear it that it is, it's the most mind-blowing one for me is, so the characters are sometimes randomly eating mustard on Parmesan cheese, and then so you make the link that Gene Parmesan played Colonel Mustard, Martin Mull, in the Clue movie. Later, Michael and Job find Colonel Mustard with the knife next to the ballroom. So then you're left to wonder whether that's just a joke in and of itself, or if it's supposed to be a big clue about the mystery of Lucille II. And that attention to detail and level of thought is just so unprecedented, except in, maybe I'm guessing, the sophisticated dramas that you watch that I've never seen.
I would say... certainly not even that. I can't think of anything. Certainly nothing comedic. I'm sure there are, you know, great novels that have this like puzzle plot, but I don't.
We're not
going to
read
any
them. Come on.
Yeah. Seriously, we're talking about a TV show for 2 hours. Let's be serious. But it's very impressive, and you know, just certain callbacks that you don't even think of. Certainly the whole ostrich storyline with Lindsay.
in some ways calls back to a line she had very early in the show where she said she cares deeply for nature, and Michael said, well, you're wearing ostrich skin boots, and Lindsay just goes, well, I don't care about ostriches. And that ends up being a whole big storyline for her. And then there are little things.
George Michael's Perfect Rhythm may have been mentioned, like, in two episodes.
Yes, it was.
That's the fulcrum of his whole plot.
Right, and, you know, they kind of repurpose, like, the cornballer into its own new thing. That's actually one thing that, Baby Talk, that's kind of one thing that kind of is being looked over by a lot of people, but that was actually a pretty impressive use of that device, too. And it gave us our first ever glimpse of George Michael's deceased mother, which I actually thought was, in its own way, kind of a touching moment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, played by the great Maria Thayer.
Just one of the best. And the age of Maria Thayer.
Absolutely. And there's another joke that I noticed, Cuatro de Cinco, which I'm pretty sure was a reference to a Barack Obama speech in which he accidentally welcomed everyone to Cinco de Cuatro back in 2009, which I don't know how many people would have picked up on. But it still has that same, you know, rewarding those who pay attention, but just taking up to, you know, the 100th level to the point where I really do think it's absolutely brilliant.
That's another one of the, like, joys of this season is in the same way that 2003 to 2006 touched on the George W. Bush era, Iraq, Michael Moore, Enron references. Now you get to see the voice of this show touch on things like Obama, the housing collapse, Herman Cain, gay marriage amendments. Imagine that Arrested Development kept going, I guess that's what would have happened, but it's so inconceivable to me. And yet here they are, straight up doing it.
Another thing that people talk about as far as this season is the use of Buster and his lack of availability, to where he's really barely a character at all for most of the first 13 episodes. He appears, he has some important moments, but really you don't get to spend any time with him until his own episode, which comes almost at the very end of the season. And it's an excellent episode, lots of great stuff from that season. Do you think that with Buster, less is more, or in this case, less was more, or do you think that the season could have benefited from a lot more Buster? Albert?
I guess it's hard to say speculatively, but I am a big Buster fan, and, you know, I would have loved to see more of him. And it is sort of conspicuous at first, you know, when you don't see him. And was that, you know, specified as a reason, his lack of availability? Or was it a creative decision? I don't know if that's been...
Justin, do you know the answer to that?
Yeah, I'm not sure whether it's ever been thrown out as anything but an assumption. If it is true, I think it just becomes a subtextual joke like so many things in the history of the show, right down to, like, Double Martas, where they work it into it by showing that, hey, Buster's been missing, but would you believe he's actually been front and center, or front and slightly to the left of all these major plot points that have happened.
And in terms
go ahead.
Of the season being, you know, darker kind of as a whole, and obviously a lot of what happens to Buster is very dark, but I think him not being there very much might, you know, have sort of an effect on that too, because, you know, even though he's sort of a pathetic character and a lot of bad things happen to him, he also is one of the more sympathetic and, I dare I say, likable characters on the show, because he is such, like, a kind of, at least I've always thought, so, like, kind of a charming in his creepy dopiness.
And more than any other show, they really do take kind of these, if it is a situation where Buster just can't be available, they really do make the best out of the situation. Like you said, Justin, by creating a situation where it actually adds to the comedy, even though they couldn't get as much out of him as they'd like to.
Which is even, like, I guess in a sense, a callback to him being the Milford guy who's neither seen nor heard. So, yeah, to use your own show's strength like that to cover up these supposed problems is, again, you're seeing some real masters at work. We've been going so long that all my adjectives are just going to max out on effusiveness, because I'm not a professional television critic. Also, I think I meant metatextual and not subtextual in my last sentence. The one time it did feel conspicuous to me was it really seemed like the part of Job's assistant was written for Buster, since he had done that on the show before.
Oh, true, true. The last thing, you know, that I was thinking of touching on as far as the fourth season goes is the ending. Because I hear when you talk about the season, Justin, you keep going back to, well, in the next part, well, then, well, when we see the next act, you know, when the story continues, and a lot of people are saying this puzzle structure hinged on the fact that things were going to wrap up at the end and come together in a satisfactory way, and it clearly left on a cliffhanger. And some would argue this cliffhanger is totally consistent with the show that could actually end that way, but it did not wrap up in a neat little bow, and it did make us all think, okay, this is going to continue. Is that okay? Why is that okay? And if it is, and would it have been better had things wrapped up in a more neat little bow? Justin, you can start, since you've kind of been the one who's been pushing that idea.
Sure. With my vast influence on social spheres.
There's a lot of pushing going on.
Just stop bullying me, Justin.
Yep. There definitely was a moment when it ended when I was like, hey, what? No. Because it felt like you were building to a big convergence at Cinco de Cuatro, where in the same way Act 3 of a regular episode of Arrested Development, everything would converge and it would be comical and mysteries would unfold and things like that. I know everything's not being filmed at once, but I mean, and I also know we've heard so much like promotional talk about it that things like Albert said about single character episodes and act one of a three act story and the prologue to the movie, we've just sort of internalized that, I guess, to accept it as part of what we're watching. But, you know, I know Back to the Future 2 and 3 were filmed at the same time, and so that is like two-thirds of a whole. I just think of it the same way. It's hard for me to fully assess it when I know I'm almost sure that the rest of this story has already been, if not written page by page, at least completely plotted out. So I don't know how long it's going to take, but to me it's a foregone conclusion, short of like catastrophe or world war, that there's going to be more of this and a resolution of the story.
And Albert, what do you think of the way it was structured, the fact that it left us hanging a little bit?
I guess in a weird way, I kind of like that more, just because it is frustrating to people, and I think I derive some type of strange pleasure in people wanting something different from what the show actually is. But, you know, I do think, yeah, I think it's deliberate. I think there is most likely, at least, if not an actual plan, but a desire to do more of this. I think they wouldn't have not just set up a cliffhanger, but in, you know, sort of multiple cliffhangers with a lot of the characters. And, you know, I don't know when that's going to happen. Obviously, season four itself existing is something of a miracle happening at all, but both the unlikeliness of the prospect and what it seems like the logistics of getting it actually produced and filmed with all the different moving parts with the various actors' availability. But yeah, I mean, if there is more, I think that would be awesome. If there isn't, I don't think I'm gonna, you know, like pine away wondering what happened to all of these characters. I think I just feel grateful that this happened at all, because it was such a sort of delightful surprise.
And Justin. Also, it, yeah, sure. Well, you have a follow up question for me, I'm sure, in my social influence. But to follow up on what he said, it did. I mean, it didn't feel to me like an Arrested Development season finale, where things tend to come full circle and parallel things, but all of those did end on cliffhangers. The first one ends with George Sr. fleeing to Mexico and escaping prison. The second one ends with him swapping Oscar in prison with him. So I don't know. I don't remember people at the time being like, how can you do this? There are so many lingering questions.
And I think part of that is an episode structure issue, where they all had on the next season of Arrested Development, and they softened the blow, whereas this, you know, boom, cut to black, which is unprecedented for Arrested Development, and it has, I think, a pop song that ends the season. There's a lot of disorienting aspects to that final episode, so I think that might make it a little bit of a, you know, a harder pill to swallow for some people.
Mm-hmm. It's just where they left things, it's not hard to pick out some of the major plots of this movie, which are going to, or, you know, whatever it is next with the mystery of Lucille Ostero, Buster being on trial for that, the extent of Michael's responsibility with that, some kind of Sally versus Lindsay election, and whatever's happening with George Sr. and so on. So, yeah, I feel like there's a whole story plot out here. Maybe it'll have to come, like, if all else fails, they'll resolve it with, like, sit down, shut up, the reunion cartoon, and play this all out. But I'm pretty optimistic.
Now, with all that being said, should a follow-up occur, the idea of a movie has been talked about by Mitch Hurwitz for years and years. Is that the ideal way to bring back or wrap up Arrested Development, or has this season kind of proven that a more extended structure where we can actually build and call back and reveal things slowly is the right way for Arrested Development to be presented in 2013? And just on top of that, do we want, you know, 2 hours more of Arrested Development, or do we want another 8 hours of Arrested Development? Albert, what do you think of the movie versus season question?
You know, movies based on TV shows are usually fairly tricky prospects. And when you think about an Arrested Development movie, like something that would actually come out in theaters, with how like complex and intricate it's become even further after season four, you know, you think, is that realistic? Like who would see it? Like, I obviously would be excited, but in terms of, like, you know, a major motion picture, that seems unlikely. I mean, it would be awesome, but it seems unlikely. I don't know, you know, what might actually happen. Or maybe, you know, a made-for-Netflix TV movie. I don't know. But just, I would say, selfishly, if I had to pick between an Arrested Development movie or another season, I would pick a season because it would be more of it.
And Justin, what do you think of that question?
Yeah, well, I mean, at this,
I just want to know what you thought of the question. Like, do you think it's a good question? You don't
solid
have to answer.
Stuff. Well phrased. I like your inflections.
Okay, actually, do answer.
Okay, I'm so won over by this season that I feel like they could accomplish anything. I'm really in a honeymoon phase here. At the same time, I got to agree with Albert. It's hard to turn down the one that gives you like seven times as much as you would have in even like a 2.5 hour movie type situation. I think like really extended episode 2+ hours that could go on Netflix might be the simplest route rather than the oddity of like the Arrested Development in theaters. I mean, I think when you conceive of this Veronica Mars movie, it's going to be pretty straightforward as far as our gal Veronica figuring out some sort of mystery throughout the whole beats of the movie, whereas it's a lot harder to recreate the feel of either an Arrested Development single episode or like modified arc of a season in the format of a movie. But, you know, give it your best shot. As far as what they're intending, I don't know how much you should really read into lines from the show where maybe reverses the line from the end of the Fox series about maybe a movie where she says she doesn't see it as a movie, maybe as a TV show. So I don't know whether that's self-referential as far as what we're watching right now or a sign of things to come.
And I think my last question after all this, after we've discussed how groundbreaking season four is, do you think that we're going to see more shows try to implement this structure where these episodes really do kind of speak to each other and there's great distance between the setup of a joke and then if it's a regular show that airs on television, many months later you're going to see the payoff to that joke or the reveal? Do you think that could benefit other shows on TV? Do you think, like, for instance, a Community could benefit from having that very complicated storytelling structure? Or do you think that this is something that really is a Netflix-only, Arrested Development-only kind of style? Albert?
Yeah, I think it's kind of a perfect storm there where they don't have the same realities that they're dealing with that a network sitcom would. Like, I don't think in this day and age a network would allow a show to get away with Arrested Development Season 4 did, and probably for very valid commercial reasons. I mean, they're there to be a mass market business, and, you know, by nature of Arrested Development already being, you know, something that so much rewards close watching, and then being on Netflix and not having the same, like, you know, living and dying by weekly ratings, they can get away with it. You know, maybe if some other show can end up using the same format, I know Netflix has other comedies that they're going to be rolling out with, possibly, but in terms of just traditional network sitcoms, I don't think it would make a lot of sense for them to do it as much as it might be fun to watch.
All right, Al, is there anything else that you guys want to add about Arrested Development, the fourth season, any other tangential things? Justin?
Well, I mean, legacy-wise, I don't think it, and in terms of, like, its groundbreakingness, I don't think it's going to affect network TV, but I do think, I mean, Netflix and its original programming, like, I'm sure that weird sexy vampire rape show that everyone's so hot on right now is not structured like the Arrested Development we just watched, and I assume House of Lies isn't. But I really think this is a trend, you know, away from traditional, the only way to watch your TV is going to be on a network schedule that runs from September to May, or even a cable schedule when it shows up for 10 episodes at some point in the year. I mean, I don't know whether you'll see, legacy-wise, whether you're going to have pale imitations the same way you saw pale imitations of the original Arrested, like that Sons and Daughters show, or if you're going to see, like, more conventional and mainstreamed versions of it, like Modern Family, which has some interesting references throughout the course of this show. And I also wonder, with this, which I'm going to go ahead and qualify as a success without seeing profit margins and things like that, and seeing something like the Veronica Mars Kickstarter, whether these, like, well-received, passionate fan base cult shows are now going to, people are going to find ways to monetize them. And I wonder if, when part of the thought behind bring Dan Harmon back to Community wasn't just, it's 13 episodes to wrap this up, who gives a shit, let Dan do it, or if someone was thinking about their own future beyond network cable and whether you can take this property and get some more out of it, and so you need the real guy in charge. Also in part because showrunners are sort of becoming celebrities to a certain circle as far as people who recognize their voice and think they're, you know, looking into this guy's mind and his whole master plan type thing. So I wonder where the line is for these cult properties as far as, like, resurrectable or not, which, you know, we'll see about Party Down. I don't know if things like, I don't know, you name it, Better Off Ted, are right below the point where someone's going to give them a fishing line to pull them out.
Albert, what about you? Do you think that, do you have anything else to add to this particular topic?
Yeah, you know, after watching all of it, the original kind of what we were told that you could watch them at any order, I'm kind of wonder why people ever thought that, you know, especially people involved in the making of the show. Like, because it really does seem to have an order, even though it is loopy, and they're not loopy as in, like, it's oriented, but loopy as in it loops around and it, you know, moves in time. But it really does seem like you do have to watch it, you know, 1 through 15, as Mitchell Horowitz said. So I kind of wonder, like, I mean, why that was ever what people were saying. And it seems like people were saying it up until maybe a week before the episodes were going to be released. And then Mitch Hurwitz was like, no, you have to watch them in order. Like, I wonder, it's kind of puzzling to me. I don't really have an eloquent point tied to that, but I just kind of wonder why at one point they were kind of thinking that. I mean, I kind of can see it, but it seems like the order was important.
I'd be interested to hear from someone who actually attempted to watch them in it's his own sequence and how that experience differed from the rest of us. But
and there are probably people
there's
who didn't know about that Mitch Hurwitz saying that you had to watch them in order, who probably just heard that you can watch them in any order and then did so and probably didn't like it. And, you know,
Yeah, if you just jumped ahead to your favorite character, that would be, you're not going to get what you're supposed to get. I mean, everything you know at a certain point in that show, you're supposed to know it or not know it.
All right, guys. Well, if there's nothing else to add, I really appreciate you guys doing this, and I really appreciate all of you guys for listening to the very first edition of Let's Just Chat. You can check out more of Albert on Newsarama.com and various other places such as The Atlantic. You could check out Justin. And the Pacific Ocean, where he likes to catch waves.
Yeah.
You can check out Justin on Google.com. Hmm?
Oh, no. Please don't.
Something.
I can be twitter.com/JMSHAPYRO.
And Albert, what is your Twitter handle?
It's AlbertXII.
And you got to go to Twitter for that. twitter.com, okay?
Well, if you type in AlbertXII, you probably can eventually figure it out.
That's right.
So,
you know what's
so why the why, Justin, in Shapiro?
It was Taken. And then I just adjusted. This was like late 90s when Y's were really cool the place
we
of Y's.
At the Y boom.
It's,
but also Giant...
that's why it's called that.
That's exactly right.
But also Justin is kind of a pyromaniac. He enjoys fireworks and lighting things on fire and all things having to do with fire.
I'm a flamer.
So,
I thought it was flamer. A shout-out to the famous member of the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants.
John St. John or something like that.
How do you know it wasn't?
Sure.
And on that note...
Well, Matt, I gotta say, like, the job you did putting this together, like, taping it separately with me and Albert, since our schedules couldn't be at the same time, I've listened to some dailies, and it sounds, like, completely coherent.
Seamless, yeah. It's as if we were doing it at the same time.
It's like if we were doing it at the same time.
It's like we were all doing it at the same time. Okay, well, on that note, thank you again for listening. Thank you to my guests. And until next time, just chat without me.